So hello, everyone. Wonderful to have you here on this Tuesday. Again, I'm Tammy Johnson, the Director of Strategic Partnerships at the Applied Research Center. Welcome all of you to the Compact for Racial Justice Forum call on race and civil rights. Just a few housekeeping notes before we get right into this call. One, I want to inform everyone that we are being recorded for the use, for ARC's use and the use of other media outlets. There are several radio stations across the country that rebroadcast this call. And ARC will post a recording of this call to our website at ARC.org on the Compact for Racial Justice page after its conclusion. So if you're unable to stay on for the entire call or have friends or allies who may want to check it out later, you can. Other Compact calls are also posted there for people to tap into. We are asking participants to direct their questions to us via email. So send us your name, your organization affiliation, if it's applicable, and questions to compact@arc.org, compact@arc.org. And unfortunately, Mr. Hillary Shelton, the director of the Washington Bureau for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, won't be able to join us today. He was actually pulled in by the White House to discuss upcoming judicial appointments. So let's wish him luck. However, next week, we will be hearing from Mr. Shelton. I will be interviewing him about that meeting and other civil rights issues coming from that discussion. And we will post that interview up to our website so people can check it out within several days after. So we will contact you via email or check out our website to find out more about our conversation with Mr. Shelton. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with us at the Applied Research Center, we are a national racial justice think tank that bridges policy, research, media advocacy, and community activism. We're hosting these series of Compact Forum calls because we believe it's really important to create a space to share ideas about how we begin to apply a racial equity framework while we're having all of these national and state-level proposals being put out there about the fate of our lives and our communities, particularly those of communities of color. So this is space that we've carved out to talk about what does racial equity mean, in this instance, in terms of civil rights reform, in terms of expanding and protecting our civil rights. The state of civil rights may not be the headline in today's news, but 71 days into the Obama administration, there is a great deal to talk about. So today, being the 82nd anniversary of Cesar Chavez's birthday and the passing of John Hope Franklin, scholar of African American history, remind us from where we've come from. But in this first 71 days of the Obama administration, we have to be reminded about how much farther we have to go. And so we want to reflect on the fact that within the first 10 days, President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, one of the pieces of legislation that our Compact for Racial Justice essay really pressed for the support of. And this bill ensures that employees alleging discrimination will be able to sue over unequal pay once discrimination is discovered, regardless of when it happened. And this was something that the U.S. Supreme Court had blocked earlier. Earlier this month, the U.S. Supreme Court narrowed the protections of the Voting Rights Act by limiting the ability of people of color to urge the drawing of influential districts and challenging the redistricting plans that dilute the vote of people of color after the 2010 census. And in California, the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments on the legality of Proposition 8 concerning the accessibility of marriage. You had civil rights groups from the Asian Pacific American Legal Center to the California NAACP that argued that the initiative process cannot be used to strip away the rights of minority communities by a simple majority vote. So there's a great deal going on here. And as we will hear from our panelists today, There's a great deal more to fight for and to defend. But this conversation is not just about defending our rights, but the illegal expansion of those rights in a way that recognizes the depth and breadth of our humanity. The Compact for Racial Justice essay on civil rights rightly asserts that new groups have gained voice over time so that our civil rights struggles include issues of gender, immigration, and sexual orientation, for instance. And while these can be distinct from racial justice, the reality is that all of these groups share a common opponent and unfortunately have limited resources. So we are linked. And losing the war on one front really does affect the battle along all the others. Too often, however, we're pitted against each other, and this is mainly because of the legacy of institutional racism, the structures and the policies that perpetuate white privilege. That is a knot that is not unusually done. But today's conversation is a small step toward acknowledging and undoing the legitimacy of that legacy. In fact, it's a perfect time to ask the question, what should Attorney General Eric Holder, Civil Rights Division Head Thomas Perez, and President Obama do when it comes to expanding and protecting all of our rights? To discuss this topic today, we have some really great speakers who are going to go into this. First up, we have R. Nuima Bagarva, who is the Director of the Education Practice at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, where she is actively engaging in litigation and advocacy to expand educational access and opportunities for students of color. Ms. Bagarva has been deeply involved in litigation, advocacy, and public education efforts around two voluntary integration cases, parents involved in community schools versus Seattle School District, and Meredith v. Jefferson County Board of Education, which was recently decided by the Supreme Court. And she is co-legal counsel representing parents in California, interveners, parents and interveners in three Proposition 209 challenges to voluntary integration efforts in the state of California. She also advises institutions of higher education on providing equal access and opportunities to all students through their admissions, financial aid, and scholarship and outreach programs. We're also honored to have Miriam Young, who is the Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. The forum bridges the many issues that confront API women in their communities. They represent a diversity of the 40-plus language groups under the Asian and Pacific Islander census category, and they advance the strategies of individual empowerment with a larger vision of mobilizing power for justice, equality, and peace. Miriam has had 10-year career in the LGBT community, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community center in New York City, where she was the most recently the director of public policy government relations, where she was responsible for the advocacy, community education, and government relations work of the center, and promote the vote, one of the country's oldest and largest LGBT voter education and mobilization projects. So thank you both for being here, and we're going to start the discussion today with Ms. Bagarva. The floor is yours.
Thank you. So I want to touch upon a few different topics. The first is that unbeknownst to many, there are a number of cases that are currently before the Supreme Court that involve civil rights, and some of them involve race as well in particular, but generally the ability in a number of areas for us to continue to enforce rights and efforts to make sure that people of color and low-income communities are not no longer discriminated against. And so I'm going to talk about a few of those cases. The second area I want to talk about briefly is what's happened with state ballot initiatives in the last election, but more importantly, sort of going into 2010, some of what may be in store going into the state ballot initiatives in that election, particularly because those efforts start now, and so it's really not that far away. And lastly, because I'm an education lawyer, want to sort of spend some time talking about the state of education and to what Tammy talked about in the beginning, really what the emphasis and focus of the federal government can be in education at this critical juncture. So first, a little bit about the Supreme Court. There are four cases that are before the Supreme Court that the Legal Defense Fund has been involved in, and I want to briefly describe to all of you. Those cases are going to be heard in April, in the last 2 weeks of April, and they're critically important cases. The first case is the Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District case number one. It is a challenge to the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. And so this is the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which it was reauthorized in 1982, and again in 2006 by unanimous vote of the Senate and a broad majority of the House. And it is a challenge to the constitutionality, in particular, of Section 5 of that act. And what Section 5 requires is that for covered jurisdictions around the United States, and these are jurisdictions that have had histories of pervasive discrimination and continue to have that kind of discrimination today, which is well documented in a lot of the briefing that's gone to the Supreme Court, that in those jurisdictions, if they are going to make a change to any of their electoral processes, that they need to go to the Justice Department and make sure that those are pre-cleared so that they don't have a discriminatory impact on communities of color. And the challenge is one that goes to one of the most important civil rights acts of this century, of the last century, but frankly in America today. It is one that we continue to see the kind of discrimination that underlies the Voting Rights Act, even in this last election, where in Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, for example, President Obama ended up with 11, 12, and 14% of the white vote, but you see that in any of the covered jurisdictions, there was the crossover vote from white populations was a lot less for President Obama than in the non-covered jurisdictions. That's just one example of the reason why and the sort of extensive record of why the Voting Rights Act is still needs to be in place and its protections for those jurisdictions and in general for voting in the United States are continue to be critically important. The second case is Ricci v. DiStefano, which is a commonly referred to as the New Haven firefighters case. And Ricci is a case in which it involves Title VII, which is protects employment discrimination in the United States. And basically, just to give some background on it, in 2003, the New Haven Fire Department held civil service examinations for promotion to lieutenant and captain, and based on the examination results, no Hispanics or African Americans would have been eligible to fill any of the lieutenant positions, and only two Hispanics would have been eligible to fill the captain positions. And so New Haven decided to not to certify the test results because it was concerned that doing so would violate Title VII. And given, obviously, the significant adverse impact on African Americans and Hispanics, but also because of the grave concerns that the tests themselves were not job-related and that there were less discriminatory methods of testing that were available. So after they made that decision, the suit now is being brought by one Hispanic and several white test takers, and they're claiming that the fact that they decided not to use the results of the promotion test and to certify those lists, that is a violation of Title VII and the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. So this is a case that builds off of the 1974 case Briggs, which was a case in which under Title VII, it says that the outcome of an employment test or qualification can be taken into account. So the fact that there were no Hispanic or African-American firefighters that would have made the ranks of lieutenant and very few for captain is something that can be taken into account when looking at that test fairness. Congress put that analysis into the 1972 amendments to Title VII, and the New Haven Fire Department is taking account of that. And like many other fire departments around this country, which have had long histories of excluding African-Americans, to give you a sort of egregious example, even as recently as 2004, there was a battalion in Cleveland where it was so segregated that they used to refer to it as the African American battalion called Monkey Island. So these are practices that continue to this day. And so the concerns about sort of discrimination within the firefighting realm are ones that this is part of what New Haven was affirmatively trying to do something about, and is it's part of their analysis that the use of these tests doesn't work here and isn't relevant. So that's the second case before the Supreme Court. The third is a case that I've worked on and so can speak about for some time, but I'll try to keep it brief, which is Horn v. Flores. It's a case out of Arizona that is widely talked about as an English language learner case, but its implications are actually quite broad, much broader and sort of not really attached as much to English language learners, but I want to talk about what happened there. In 2000, a district court ruled that the state of Arizona hadn't provided a rational basis for how it was funding the services for English language learners, and those were, and that those students, and particularly in Nogales, which is a district that's very close to the border, that in Nogales and in other parts of Arizona, students, English language learner students were not getting the sort of basic educational opportunities they needed to succeed, but as importantly, whatever models were put in place, they weren't getting the funding to make sure that those could be viable and sustainable over time, and the state of Arizona never complied with the district court's request for a rational funding structure or a way in which they could actually measure that and come up with a way to ensure that students receive those kind of services over time. And there was a lot of back and forth where the state legislature essentially at the end of the day decided that it would try to move to get out of the judgment of the district court, even though it never complied with it and it never appealed it. And so both of the courts below and the district court in Arizona and then the Ninth Circuit in California denied their request, but they then went to the Supreme Court and they're arguing a couple things. One is, we've been able to raise test scores in Arizona for English language learner students at least to such a degree that we think that we comply with the No Child Left Behind Act, and therefore we don't need to comply with the Equal Education Opportunity Act, which is another federal act that applies to English language learner students or any other civil rights statutes perhaps, because our compliance with NCLB means we're doing whatever we need to do to serve English language learner students and other, so targeted student populations. And then their second argument is that we've done enough to try and make sure that we're in compliance with the district court order, and frankly, they've overstepped their bounds. Again, let me reiterate that they've never complied with the district court order's request, which was pretty limited. It's, if you're going to do something, fund it, and give me a basis for which you're going to fund it. And lastly, the Cuomo case. Now, the Cuomo case comes out of New York, and it's a case that is about the power of states to use their own anti-discrimination laws to investigate discrimination or fears of discrimination in subprime lending. So New York's Attorney General, Cuomo, launched an investigation in 2005 into the lending practices of banks in New York, and there were a number of private lawsuits alleging discrimination in subprime lending at that time, and it was widely sort of discussed in the press. But the federal government went to court and said, we want New York to stop those investigations because New York and every other state is forbidden from engaging in those investigations because enforcement authority has been given to the federal government and the federal government alone. So this is a question about whether or not states can actually take steps to ensure that there are not discriminatory practices in subprime lending, which obviously is of critical importance today. And frankly, civil rights have always benefited when states and federal governments both seek to enforce anti-discrimination laws, and that you'd have multiple protections and different ways in which the citizens and residents of the state of New York and elsewhere have the kind of protections they need in place. So those are the four cases. Tammy described Bartlett v. Strickland, which was a Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act case that came out earlier this term. But three of these cases were taken up by the Supreme Court just shortly before President Obama's inauguration, and their concerns that this is them reminding us that we have we still have a long way to go for racial progress, and there may be some obstacles in our way. Secondly, I want to talk about state ballot initiatives. The Legal Defense Fund, along with many others, was and many local, incredible local partners, was involved with the state ballot initiatives that are sort of Prop 209, as I like to call it, taken on the road. So these are all ballot initiatives that were in five states, proposed in five states for the November 2008 election to ostensibly stop discrimination or the granting of preferences based on race or gender, but essentially would end any programs that really are trying to address racial and gender inequalities and affirmative action programs in public education, employment, and contracting. They are all sponsored in part by Ward Connerly and actually, frankly, funded exclusively by Ward Connerly and his American Civil Rights Foundation out of California. And the states that those ballot initiatives were proposed were Arizona, Colorado, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Nebraska. And different from in years past where those kind of ballot initiatives have gone through in California, Washington, and in 2006 in Michigan, in this election cycle, in Arizona, Colorado, Missouri, and Oklahoma, these ballot initiatives were defeated either before they got to the ballot because of signature deficiencies and other invalidity, or at the ballot in the case of Colorado. So Nebraska is the only state where this ballot initiative passed. The reason I raise this is because we think of this as part of the larger assault on any efforts to sort of voluntarily and consciously be able to address racial and gender inequalities and inequalities in many of the other, by national origin and sexual orientation and lots of other ways that we see all around this country. And they're coming back. So Missouri is already, Connerly is already slated Missouri to be on the, to try it again for 2010. And as I mentioned before, we see that the process to make sure that these kinds of ballot initiatives get on the ballot in a fair way, and that voters have an understanding of what's at stake here is something that's going to take some time. And so we want to, keep our eye on that. Lastly, in terms of education, there's, we are clearly in every way, shape, or form in the same kind of education crisis that we've seen for so many years in this country. To give a sense, the one of the focal points that we have here at LDF is on graduation rates, as, do many organizations around this country. But when you have a graduation rate from high school that's around 50% in public high schools and, can go as low as 24% in the city of Detroit, vast differences when you look at students who are attending schools in racially isolated communities, low-income concentrated poverty communities, it is something that is of grave concern. For this administration, there are many things that that we'd like to see: the enforcement of Title VI, which prohibits racial discrimination, and part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which after a 2000 Supreme Court decision is something that the federal government is in a position to try and enforce, but not private actors, and that's something that we'd like to see, sort of more fully invigorated and enforced, many of the disparities that we continue to see, but also to really look at what we need to, what's going on in terms of the exclusionary practices. So why is it that we're losing nearly half of our population? Where are they going, and what kind of school policies and other kind of policies are in place, and what can we do to address those? So that's one part of it, and obviously the efforts to try and address racial isolation in schools after the Supreme Court's decisions in 2007, which were out of Seattle and Louisville, but look to sort of what school districts can do to try to promote school diversity and racial isolation now is also something that's come up quite a bit and will continue to be a realm where school districts have less tools, but as many challenges to make sure that students aren't, in as segregated as schools as they have been since 1970, which is currently what we're looking at. In the South, it's even worse. And so we're going back to, separate but unequal, which is obviously a serious problem. So So I'll stop there, and Miriam and I can take questions after I think she's done. So.
Great. Before Miriam starts, thank you for that. I just want to remind people to send in their questions via email to compact@arc.org, compact@arc.org. Go ahead, Ms. Young.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Miriam Young, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, as you heard, NAPOF for short. Thank you, Tammy, for pulling this call together, and I'm sorry if I made you sweat in that last minute. National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum is a progressive multi-issue organization that is building a movement of Asian and Pacific Islanders for social justice and human rights. We are a membership organization with chapters in New York, D.C., Yale University, Chicago, University of Michigan, St. Cloud, Minnesota, Seattle, Sacramento, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas. We have staff offices in New York City, D.C., and Oakland. I know that's a lot of places I just mentioned. I do so for a couple of reasons. One, like a rock concert, it's fun to hear your city get spoken out loud during a phone conference or two. And it's, you know, late in the afternoon, so I figured any shtick I can use. And I'm going to keep giving my chapters, at least, shout-outs until we're in all 50 states in the U.S., which is certainly our ambition. So before I start my remarks and tell a story, I want to just go over some basics. You know, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders represent a little over 4% of the total U.S. population, or nearly 12 million people. This number is set to double by the year 2050. As you all know, the Asian and Pacific Islander community is also extremely culturally diverse. We comprise over 30 ethnic subpopulations, which speak more than 200 languages and dialects. I think this gives us something to chew on as we think about language access, as we just heard. About 40% of API people are limited English proficient as well. We're also really class diverse. While API families on average are more likely than white families to have household incomes of over $75,000, we are also more likely than white families to have incomes of less than $25,000. A look at data on API communities disaggregated by ethnicity show us that there are huge disparities within our community. So the prevailing image or stereotype that Asians are the high-achieving doctors of the world overshadows two important facts. One, a lot of us are not well off, especially if we came to this country as refugees or from Southeast Asia or migrated from the Pacific Islands. And two, there are a lot of us with disappointed Asian moms, my own included, who wanted us to be doctors but aren't. By the way, this is also a good example of why disaggregated data is so important, and I'm glad to see that this point was reiterated in the compact. Approximately 60% of APIs are foreign-born, and we represent one-fourth of the nation's total foreign-born population. And it's estimated that 1 in 10 Asian Americans are undocumented. According to the last census, half of all APIs in the U.S. live in the West, 12% in the Midwest, 19% in the East, and 19% in the South. 95% of all APIs live in metropolitan areas, with over half of us in just three states. And I'll give you three guesses: California, New York, and Hawaii. 50% of Asian Pacific Islander women in the U.S. are within reproductive age. I recite all this as a backdrop because while our numbers may be smaller relative to our other brothers and sisters of color in the U.S., and whereas we are often a community of color in reference to or sometimes painfully wedged between the black-white dialogue in this country, or left out completely of the dialogue, Asians and Pacific Islanders make up 60% of the world population. And I mention this because I'm going to tell a story of a current civil rights struggle that we are fighting. And in the foreground, I think, highlights certainly the intersection of race and gender. But in the background, offers us some lessons in the way a human rights approach may offer us some solutions to think about. And this is actually late-breaking news. We found out yesterday that this was happening again. But at 1 o'clock this afternoon, Congressman Trent Franks, who is a Republican from Arizona, held a press conference to mark the introduction of the Susan B. Anthony Prenatal Non-Discrimination Act, or PRENDA for short, which purports to address gender and racial inequality by punishing doctors who perform abortions for race or sex selection purposes. in reality, the bill exacerbates injustice and is just the newest weapon in the anti-choice arsenal, this time clearly attempting to wedge the people of color community from each other and people of color from the reproductive rights, health, and justice community. And Susan B. Anthony is probably rolling in her grave right now. While son preference is a real issue in some parts of the world, mainly India and China and Korea, it's linked to deeply seated structural sexism. And in the U.S., we also have our own versions of structural sexism, and we also have our own version of sex selection. We usually call it by the name family balancing. That is, when white people do it. Also, this is the second time around for this bill. Last year, Congressman Franks introduced it around the same time and stood on a stage with Alveda King, a leader of the black anti-choice movement, who sells the claim that black women who get abortions are practicing racial genocide. This bill, PRENDA, would call into question any time a woman of color has an abortion and potentially exposes doctors to liability if they provide this medical service to any woman of color. And it's using a made-up, misappropriated anti-discrimination platform. In this case, they're thinking about anti-discrimination for the fetus. Fetus as a human, fetus as a person is a whole new tact that the anti-choice community is taking. So let me be clear, though. There is a little bit of evidence that points to the idea that some API communities in the U.S. may be preferring sons over daughters. And, of course, there is racism alive and well in this country. However, the way to address sexism and racism is not this way. Rather, the bill will effectively exacerbate already existing disparities by limiting some women's access to comprehensive reproductive health care and penalizing health care providers. Instead of addressing health disparities and ensuring accessible and culturally competent medical care for all women, PRENDA would further isolate and stigmatize some women, particularly those in the Asian American and Pacific Islander and African American communities, from exercising their fundamental human right and civil right to make and implement decisions about their reproductive lives. I can think of no other decisions that are more personal and dear and close to us. To end structural racism and sexism, what we need to do is actually, I think, look at the way human rights offers us some useful tools. In particular, whereas civil rights in the U.S. are largely negative rights that protect the individual citizen from the government, human rights offers that governments actually have the affirmative obligation to ensure, monitor, and preempt violations against all of our human rights. If the U.S. utilized the human rights approach, the government would be responsible for implementing solutions aimed at wage, employment, education, and health gaps in this country based on race, sex, sexual orientation, all of those things that we've been talking about. So a couple of take-home points that I want to drive home here. One, certainly women's rights are civil rights. And two, gender and race can't be divorced from each other in our discussions about civil rights. To do so opens up our movement up to wedges and attacks, and it's a weakness that can clearly be exploited by those on the other side. Thirdly, human rights offers us some interesting directions for the future in community organizing and increasingly for legal doctrine, and I'd love for us to think more about this on this call. Lastly, you know, this bill is rolling. It has just gotten reintroduced, and we are calling on our allies to stand in opposition to this with us. The first time around, we were able to pull together a diverse coalition of Asian, Latino, African American groups with reproductive rights groups, with violence against women groups to oppose this bill. By the way, many of these groups had never sat at the same table before this occasion. We will be likely circulating a sign-on letter once again to make sure that this bill doesn't get out onto the floor. And I invite you to check in with me to stay in the loop and to be connected if you're interested. It's also interesting to note that this kind of bill is also cropping up in the states. And we're looking to partner with groups in Oklahoma and Minnesota in particular who have been working on this issue on the ground. So if you have interest or constituencies in those states, I'd also be especially glad to talk with you after this call. And I think at this point, I'd love to open it up to questions and discussion and talking.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Young. A lot of food for thought there, and I've gotten several really good questions via email. Before I get into that, I just want to remind people once again that you can send me your questions to compact@arc.org. So the question I think I want to start with is one that several people are asking, which has to do with really dealing with all of these different constituencies that are A, laying claim to the civil rights banner, but not necessarily working well together, something that you mentioned at the end of your talk, Miriam. There's been some tensions, responder asked, linking civil rights and LGBT rights as well as civil rights to immigrant rights. What are some ways to effectively address some of these tensions and to create some bridges across communities that allow people to really fight together on these issues? I know you begin to touch on that, but I also would like to hear from Ms. Bhargava about her experience of working across groups on some of these issues, particularly coming out of the Prop 8 fight here in California. Hello?
Sorry, I didn't know which one of us was going first. this is Anarima. So the NAACP Legal Defense Fund was one of the groups, along with the National Asian Pacific American Legal Center and the California NAACP and a number of others, the Equal Justice Society, who did actually submit a brief into the California Supreme Court on Prop 8. It is, I think, just one example of a number of ways in which cases that have implications, but even those that may not have obvious implications for, sort of a broad spectrum of communities where people are really sort of coming together, not only to say that, what happens to one particular community can impact and affects us all, but also to say that when we are protecting rights, we have to, if one fundamental right can be subject to a bare majority, any of our fundamental rights can be, and that we need to be mindful of that as well. But that's the reason I say it's one of the examples. I mean, any of the cases that I've worked on, mainly in the education context, that have been in California and around the country on efforts of schools to promote diversity and provide a quality education in to communities of color have been coalition efforts. And so it has been the Legal Defense Fund with the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund and the Asian Pacific American Legal Center and others. Now, the issues about sort of a case like Horn v. Flores, the Arizona bilingual, the English language learner case, is one where clearly there are immigrant populations that are impacted, but the issues and the concerns to civil rights communities broadly is one where we've seen all kinds of voices come into the Supreme Court and into that case over its long duration to say that it's important that that we provide basic educational opportunities for all. So when we talk about some of these broader principles, I think it is a place where we do see some cross-cutting support, not only within sort of and among racial groups, but also between sort of different identified communities.
Do you
want to
chime in on that?
Yeah, I think the what happened in Prop 8 was really instructive. First off, I think that the fight for same-sex marriage is, in my mind, clearly a civil rights fight. Certainly the right to marry who you love and desire is fits within my framework of understanding civil rights. And I think what happened in Prop 8, remember, after it went the wrong way, was that there was a chorus of voices right afterwards that blamed it on people of color, in particularly African Americans, Latinos, and Asians. And there was all this kind of post-op polling that happened that showed 40% of this, 60% of that, 70% of that. Even though we voted for Obama, they didn't like gay people. And I think that there was a lot of exposure in the blogosphere and in the community forums afterwards, talking about I think, some longstanding tensions that do exist between people of color and the LGBT rights movement. Certainly the LGBT movement is not devoid of its own sexism, racism, or even transphobia or classism and all of that. So I think that Prop 8 was a big lesson and wake-up call for folks in the LGBT community who may not have seen the need for doing good outreach in POC communities. And I think there was a lesson also embedded in not, what do they call it, parachuting into a community, right, in the last final hours and asking for support, and yet not showing up for affirmative action or not showing up for English learner bills or not showing up for race-based hate crimes or not showing up for welfare reform or all of those things. So there has been a growing progressive queer left in this country that has been making these connections, and I think I'm excited to see that that they have been able to elevate this discussion to really doing more of this coalition work and defeating some of those tensions that exist and addressing some longstanding structural racism and sexism that exists even within some of our progressive movements.
Another question that's come up in several of the responders is, what can be done to restore the effectiveness of the Office of Civil Rights at various agencies so that we can actually get some enforcement and protections? Likewise, what can be done to make the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights more useful? There may be a need to have some explanation of some of those functions. People are not necessarily aware that actually various agencies within the government, whether it's HUD or agencies that deal with labor law, for instance, or EEOC, actually have some civil rights directives behind them that, let's say, for the last 8 years have either gone latent or even gone backwards. So the question is, how do we reinvigorate and get them to protect and enforce and expand and not just wait until something gets to the Supreme Court? Is there any thoughts around that?
There's lots of thoughts around that, and I think that there have been, both in the transition time and coming, as the nominations for Office for Civil Rights, whether it be at the Department of Education or the Health and Human Services, and frankly, in the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice, how it is that those offices can regain some of the vibrancy and frankly can move from a place where they used to have they would investigate or have compliance reviews, which are sort of the sort of most robust level of investigation that they would do, be it numbers of like 160, 170 to 6 in the Department of Education as one example, and all those 6 are not ones that were brought by people of color. So to try and really change that tide, it's going to start with, obviously, with the staff and the personnel who are in those offices. I think it starts with the offices for civil rights being places that are of top priority for the various secretaries that are in place, so that we look to, because I work in education, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, one of the first nominations that he made was to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights. That's important. I think it sends an important signal about the importance of civil rights within, his administration, that we continue to demand, and for all of us as communities around this country and in advocacy groups, for us to use the Office for Civil Rights and to use the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and hold them accountable, and to continue to sort of send in our own complaints and concerns that we've been having. Those have sort of reached a blind eye for some time, but it's up to us to join in that effort to reinvigorate with the people who are gonna lead those efforts from the inside. So I think it's both transformation from the inside, but also for us to start to think about government as a place that we can sort of press the concerns that we've had in all of these different areas, and that we look to those agencies as partners, but also to continue to pressure them and monitor them to make sure they're doing what exactly they need to be doing.
And I know just from an organizing standpoint of view, on various issues. We have a rich history that we need to go back and visit of groups demanding that agency departments stop civil rights violations. I know during the height of the battle against the Clinton welfare reform, lots of welfare rights groups actually submitted civil rights petitions against local agencies that were violating the rights of women who were blocked to access to food stamps and to other services, and just in the way that they were treated was violations. So some of that could be leverage points in terms of organizing as well, and maybe we should revisit some of those actions as case studies, and again demand, for instance, that these U.S. commissions start having more local hearings on issues around employment and housing and things of that nature. And this kind of connects to the next question I want to put before both of you, which has to do with the economy in terms of the fact that so many people of color have already lost or are in the process of losing their jobs in this time, and especially those who have criminal records or who may not have papers because they're undocumented, they face even higher employment barriers. What can the Office of Civil Rights do to help protect them, especially when there's discrimination in the way that the process oftentimes goes? And I also want to say, in the mix, a growing number of ex-offenders are women of color who are a growing number of nonviolent drug offenders who definitely are in this category in terms of having barriers to employment. A lot of people are talking about the potential of the green job sector, and I know there's some good work going on by Green for All and others to ensure that those jobs get to our communities. But from the civil rights standpoint of view, how can we make there's checks and make sure that there's checks and balances in that area? And talk a little bit maybe also about the organizing that may need to happen around that.
This is Miriam. I think absolutely there needs to be a ton of organizing around this. We are still in the stages of really collecting these stories to understand what's happening on the ground, and to tell the realer stories of what's happening. I know you guys are collecting stories on your website. Because the major kind of big thing that the media keeps talking about is how women are going to outnumber men in the workforce for the first time because men are losing their jobs, or 80% of men are losing their jobs or something like that. And the underlying piece that I keep thinking about is that, women were underpaid to begin with and that it's cheaper to keep women than men. In many ways, if we're still making 75 cents on an hour, right, like you can get, what is that, 3 for $5, right? Like that has been a longstanding issue, and I think we haven't used the civil rights frame enough to organize around that, and I'm interested in doing that.
The final question, actually there was two, and this one from a pre-law student out of the University of Dayton, Ms. Randall, asked how ARC is addressing the broader racial justice agenda within the Obama administration. And I want to just remind people that the final phone call in this series on April 28th will be a 100-day review where we will take a bigger holistic look at what has happened and really talk about how what has happened either lines up or doesn't with the principles that we put out around the Compact for Racial Justice. But her second question is really interested in that she's talking about the Obama administration's refusal to attend the UN Conference Against Racism in Geneva because the issue of human rights was brought up, and what does that mean, and how do we respond to that? And I just do want to talk about that a little bit in terms of, we will be in the next week or so, there will be a blog post on RaceWire that will address that. And the reality is that at Durban, it was 8 years ago now, in terms of the conversation around race amongst especially the NGO groups that attended the informal conference that happened, I do feel there was some agreement around the need to directly address issues of race and structural and institutional racism within all of our countries and how that issue really does touch other issues around gender and sexuality, and how this really at this point we cannot be put in a place where we're asked to separate out, because one does impact the other, and the insidiousness of that is what will not only tear us apart but leave us weaker in the battle to really address this. And so we do have to hold the Obama administration accountable for not attending. And it's one, you know, on one hand to say that you're going to go into foreign relations as a negotiator and be willing to talk to anyone. On the other side, to say that you're not going to go to this conference and deal with the real issues of racism, both within your country and how racism plays out within our foreign policy, is very problematic. And we do take issue with that here at ARC. And the third report that we prepared back in 2001, unfortunately, the conclusions around issues around race in schools, race in employment, and on down the line, those issues still remain today, which is what part of the reason why we're having these calls and why we created the Compact for Racial Justice, because it is a challenge for the Obama administration to step up to the 21st century realities and move a racial justice frame. This is an opportunity, but I think it's also an opportunity for us to create the demand, to really give people the tools and the knowledge to do this fight, and also to tell people who's out there fighting in terms of other groups who are on the ground, who's, you know, at the White House right now talking to the president about these things, who's in the Beltway, who's at the state capitol, who's in the community doing the work, because all of those dots have to be connected and have to be echoed up and out if we're going to be successful in terms of this issue. I don't know if either of one of our callers wants to speak to those concerns, but I felt that was very important to really get at.
I think it is important, and today there was an announcement that the U.S. actually will join the U.N. Human Rights Council, which is, you know, good news, even in light of the fact that they refused to engage sort of on the Durban follow-up. But, you know, I think that there's, you know, we're going to see, you know, steps in the right direction and steps, you know, sideways. And I think it's, again, as you just mentioned, really important that, you know, we don't assume that this government's going to take care of itself. And so our roles are going to be as important, if not more important, you know, moving forward in terms of keeping, you know, the eye on the prize and our you know, facing forward and making sure that those who are on the inside and who are, you know, who are allowing us to engage, you know, sort of more richly with the world, that we do that in the right way. One last note, this is on air again. I on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, you know, I don't know what the timing is for appointments to that commission, but it may be, and there's been a lot of discussion about sort of the commission and how it's constituted in its role, but I do think it's something to watch to make sure that, you know, that it may be some time before we see that commission really sort of live up to its name, unless there's some dramatic changes. So it definitely has not lived up to that name for the last 8 years.
Miriam, would you like to have some last words?
I want to echo what Anurima said. Totally agree about lots of things to watch. I think also in the White House, under the Clinton years, there used to be a White House initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, and I think the desire to continue that is not as strong as we might have imagined. And I think there are a host of reasons why, but, you know, if we're not going to do specific race or ethnicity-based initiatives at the White House anymore, I think absolutely we need to look at other ways that racial justice concerns can be addressed. And I think you're absolutely right. We continue have to hold his feet to the fire and say what we want to the White House. And, you know, the good part of the story is that we have a lot of access to the White House, right? Like, our message can be heard. And I think this is the moment for us as activists and advocates to put our noses together and to the grindstone to figure out exactly what we would like them to do and to help them out with that part of it.
Yes, we have to create the demand, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, before I end, I want to first thank both of my panelists who really given up their time today and really given us a lot of very useful information. Please do visit their websites and get informed and get involved with the activities that they're engaged in, because this is really, even though it may not be headline news, it will be the thing that impacts every one of our lives in a very intimate way in terms of whether or not our rights are protected, enforced, and expanded. And before I end, I want to encourage all of you to check out the Compact for Racial Justice on webpage at arc.org and to sign the Pledge for Racial Justice. We also want you to review some resources, some new resources that we put up on that page. Again, the MP3 audio of this call will be placed up there for those of you who missed part of it or want to have allies and friends check it out. There's also a video regarding building alliances among communities of color and LGBT groups that's posted on that same page that you may want to check out. And final, two other things. There's a racial equity impact assessment overview and guide that we've recently updated, which is an assessment tool on how to have a systematic examination of how different racial and ethnic groups will be affected by particular policy proposals. And there are even some very short examples of how that's done in particular cities in the U.S. and in the United Kingdom. Finally, there's a great new blog on these issues on racewire.org that you should also check out. So thanks to everyone who took an hour out of their day to be a part of this call. I hope that you would do so again on April 14th, where the topic will be race and the recession. How are we doing? What's going on? How will we move forward in this really very tricky economic times? And, again, that's April 14th at the same time. And, again, thank you so much for giving up your time today. Have a great day.